Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The UN Secretary General has condemned in the strongest terms a brutal attack on a Catholic church in southwest Nigeria at the weekend, which left at least 50 people dead and wounded dozens more. In a statement, Antonio Guterres described the attack in the St. Francis Catholic Church in Owe Ondo State as heinous, as worshippers gathered on Sunday to celebrate Pentecost, an important date in the Christian calendar. According to reports, attackers infiltrated the congregation before shooting at people who'd gathered for Mass inside the church. Attacks on places of worship are abhorrent, the UN Secretary General added, before urging the Nigerian authorities to spare no effort in bringing those responsible to justice. To date, no group has claimed responsibility for the attack, which is considered unusual for southwest Nigeria. It is a more peaceful region than the country's north, where there have been numerous kidnappings for ransom by bandits and past attacks on churches by separatists. Echoing Mr. Guterres' condemnation of the killings, the UN Alliance of Civilizations, UNAOC, called for the mutual respect of all religions and faiths and for greater communal efforts to foster peace. The UN agency is behind a plan of action to keep places of worship safe and to allow people of all faiths to practice their religions in peace. In light of the attack, UNAOC High Representative Miguel Moratinos urged all governments to support the plan's implementation. Renewed concern about desperate hunger levels in Somalia and the wider Horn of Africa now, amid reports that parents have had to bury their starving children by the roadside as they try to seek life-saving medical help. The alert on Tuesday from UN humanitarians follows four successive seasons of failed rains, a situation not seen in at least 40 years, which have left 386,000 children in acute need of life-saving treatment for severe malnutrition in Somalia alone. This is worse than in 2011, when famine claimed the lives of 250,000 in Somalia, most of them children. From the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, here's Rania Dagash, Deputy Regional Director for Eastern and Southern Africa.
The lives of children in the Horn of Africa are also at an increased risk because of the war in Ukraine. And I think it's important to emphasize this because Somalia alone used to import 92% of its wheat from Russia and Ukraine, but supply lines are now blocked.
In addition to calling on the international community to provide more funding for emergency assistance, UN humanitarians have stressed that what is also needed is investment in resilience-building measures to save people's livelihoods and prevent them from having to leave their homes in search of food, water and healthcare. To Ukraine and the devastated port city of Mariupol, where worrying reports of cholera haven't yet been officially confirmed, the UN Health Agency said on Tuesday. Speaking to journalists in Geneva, Dr. Margaret Harris from the World Health Organization, WHO, said that the agency has previously issued warnings that the preventable disease could easily spread in Mariupol, where water and sewage pipes have been destroyed by weeks of shelling that followed the Russian invasion on the 24th of February. Cholera prevention and treatment kits have been put in place, along with preparation measures for vaccines, Dr. Harris said. She noted that Mariupol experienced a cholera outbreak in the summer of 2011. To date, the latest reports of the cholera outbreak have not been confirmed by laboratory analysis, she added. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
In opposition to the global trade agreements.
We need to see the world anew, reframe all those debates that lead us to believe that free markets have triumphed, free trade is always good for everyone, citizens are now customers, democracy is equated with markets. So cuts in jobs must be inevitable.
Hazel Henderson on the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
Yes, you can contribute to the second hour following.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
This week on Radio Eco Shock. Who will suffer more climate change disasters than any other country? The people of India. Calling in from the hot zone, veteran Asia correspondent Bill Spindle explains why energy choices in India could determine the future for you and the world. From Potsdam, atmospheric chemist Kathleen Marr warns our system underestimates the growing danger of methane, that other major warming gas. Soon enough, this civilization will be swamped with continuing hits as climate breaks down. Forget disaster declarations. It's all year for fires, floods, droughts, and weird crop-killing weather. If we do not contain everyday pollution of the atmosphere, the land, and the seas, catastrophe will be the new normal, won't it? That is the scientific fact. Reality is becoming unreal for many. Where is the stable ground, the place safe enough to make a stand? Nobody can take plans or actions for granted. Can we maintain enough order to make the great changes we need? Is there any steering left on this bus? I am sorry if you are down at times. It is understandable in a mad, mad world. Please do find enough joy to save in some safe place, to feed on when the soul gets hungry. Part of that joy for me is to witness and to grow in understanding. We try to do that here on Radio EcoShock with wise voices from all over the world. Welcome to that world, as it is and as it could be. What if a game-changing climate event struck on the other side of the world and you didn't know much about it? India and Pakistan just went through a record-smashing early heat wave, lasting not days, but months. Bindle was there. Bill is a Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow in India. Before that, he was South Asia Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. Where are you located right now, Bill?
Hey, Alex. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. I am currently in Ratnagiri is the name of the town or the area along the Konkan coast, which is south of Mumbai, 4 hours drive south along the coast.
I think the furthest south I've been along that way is Goa.
Yes, I'm a little north of Goa, sort of in between Mumbai and Goa. And as you may or may not know, your listeners, I'm on a long journey through India. I started all the way on the other side of the country in Kolkata, visited a number of areas there, came across the country through the Northwest deserts, down through Mumbai, and then I'm now heading south. And I'll go across the country and back up again in a big circle. And the whole time I'm looking at sort of climate impacts along the way and also energy transition issues in various places. So we can take it from there.
Well, that's perfect for this show. That's what we're about. What was it like day to day in that massive heat wave?
Hot. It's a kind of oppressive heat. I would just describe it as like having when you're in a taxi with the window open, and some of the taxis here are not air conditioned. If you have the window open, it's like having a blow dryer right into your face. And the most difficult thing is it really doesn't recede a lot in the evening, especially in the cities. And so, as you can imagine, most Indians don't have any sort of air conditioning. That's just beginning here. The middle class is able to get some air conditioning, but mostly Indians don't have any air conditioning, and many in rural areas or in urban slums don't have even fans. So their situation really becomes quite dire under those kind of conditions, especially when they go on sort of day after day, week after week, as they did this spring, where we touched, you know, temperature highs that really would be records even in the summer, when the heat, like now, is really generally when the heat really starts to pick up. But it began really in March this year.
Well, they found in other places, including in Britain, that when heat events happen at an unexpected time of year, the first one to come actually causes more deaths than subsequent ones, where people are a little more mentally and maybe physically prepared.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it did catch people unawares here. And the real only saving grace of it all is that it came before the rainy season, so you didn't have high humidity in many places where you would normally have higher humidity if the rains had come, because that's really the great fear that everyone has going forward as temperatures begin to sort of rise, is this what's called the wet bulb temperature, the combination of humidity and heat, which doesn't, if you have high humidity, it doesn't require incredibly unprecedented heat to get to a point where the human body really can't cool itself down, because it can't sweat off can't cool its core by sweating. And so you can get, even in the low 90s, if the humidity's high enough, you can get lethal levels. And we didn't have that during this particular heat wave, but that is a big fear for the future.
Was there smog as well in the cities?
The smog tends to recede in the spring. It's the worst in the winter because of the way the cool air is trapped by the Himalaya Mountains, and you get a buildup of smog similar to what LA used to have in the 70s. So the smog wasn't that bad, but air is never very – air pollution levels, even in the best parts of the year, are really quite bad, particularly in northern India.
Well, let's see what the record keepers say. The Scientific American writes, quote, "Northwestern and central India, some of the worst affected regions, are believed to have experienced their hottest April on record. The country as a whole saw its hottest March in 122 years of recorded history and its fourth hottest April this year." End quote. This sounds like a breakthrough climate event. Bill, do you see it that way?
Yes and no. I think it is an event that really got everyone's attention, not only globally, but here in India. And it really raised awareness of the acute threat that various climate impacts have. On the other hand, India has had big heat waves before. Slowly, there's been a realization that particularly cities need to prepare themselves for this. And there's been a spread of these so-called heat action plans. There was a big heat wave in the Northwest, I think it was 2011, perhaps, where a couple thousand people died. And so they've come up with plans that try to better predict these events, try to get the word out to particularly poorer communities that this is happening, try to get workers off the streets, try to distribute water. And they, you know, they do help. And I think this is a broad theme, really, in sort of climate-related events in the developing world, particularly India, is the way that there are ways people can respond to these things. They can adapt. Communities can figure out ways to mitigate the damages, the threats. Cyclones are a big example. You know, massive cyclones have hit the coast, used to kill thousands and thousands of people. Through fairly simple measures, like just having much better predictive capabilities that through weather forecasting advances and building big kind of hurricane shelter, cyclone shelters in even really poor rural areas where a whole village can go up and get above the water, have really cut the deaths down dramatically. And you see some of the same phenomenon with heat. By reacting to it with a coordinated plan, they can reduce the mortality levels and stuff. But the important thing to understand is there are limits to this sort of adaptation. You can only do it to a certain extent, at which point it begins to overwhelm the system and you really can't mitigate for it anymore. You can't really adapt to it in any ways. And I think that's the big fear going forward, is that these events become more common as they're accompanied by other climate events that we can talk about. I mean, these heat issues are far from the only climate impacts I've seen on my trip so far, and that India is experiencing. So as these kind of different climate effects, you know, they kind of collide into each other, they reverberate, they cascade on each other, it becomes more and more difficult to adapt. So there's just limits to how much you can do, even though there is a lot you can on all of these fronts and a lot that Indians are trying to slowly do. There simply are limits to it over time.
This is going to come back. The UK Met Office saw proper to issue a special assessment on May the 18th, and they said the chances of a record-breaking heat wave in that part of the world has been made over 100 times more likely because of climate change. So it's going to come back. Now, writing in the Atlantic magazine in May, you said the world has no choice but to care about India's heat wave. Why is that?
I think there are a number of reasons about it. I think, you know, first off, India is now the second most populous country in the world. About 1.4 billion people live in India. By the end of the decade, it'll be the most populous country in the world. So just simply from a humanitarian perspective, India will likely be the country that experiences where the most people experience the most severe impacts of climate change. So simply as a humanitarian matter of just caring about other human beings, this is the place, India is the place where the most people will experience the most extreme impacts likely over the next couple of decades. But that then definitely reverberates out beyond the country and has global implications. You know, there are certainly concerns about migration. If large swaths of India become essentially uninhabitable, those people will have to move elsewhere. And, you know, those will cause disruptions both across borders and within India. It will have a big impact on the economy. And to the extent that, for example, America is increasingly moving into a partnership with India in the Indo-Pacific, for example, for security reasons, for trade and economic reasons. You know, an India that is hobbled and struggling with climate impacts throughout the next several decades is simply not going to be as good a partner, both economically, security-wise, or anything else, as an India that is got these problems in and these challenges under control. So those are some of the reasons. I think another is simply that India, on the other flip side of the coin, has a huge amount to offer in terms of mitigation of climate change globally. It's already the third largest contributor to emissions on a historical level, of course, very little contribution, cumulatively over time on a per capita basis, very small compared to Europe, the United States especially, or even China. Yet it is emitting quite a bit more fossil fuels, and it is very dependent on coal. So whether India and how India is able to get its renewable energy sector moving, and we can talk about that. There's just been huge progress in that area. India's got great promise in things like solar, wind, and is moving into this whole hydrogen space. So India has a lot to offer in terms of both cutting its own emissions over time by building a whole new energy system based on, you know, with its backbone in renewables. It's well on the way to starting that project and is making really quite amazing, remarkable progress in some ways. So that's, you know, I think that's another important reason. And beyond India, it will show the rest of the developing world ways in which to go about this challenge of how do you build a sort of new energy system on top, you know, instead of Europe and the United States, which essentially have to replace an existing huge energy system. India doesn't really have to do that quite so much, and places like Africa really don't need to do that at all. They don't have a giant energy system built up based on fossil fuels yet. And India can really, I think, be a leader in showing how to build out a new energy system as opposed to replacing an existing one. And that's really the challenge that India has and the developing world has.
In the West, billionaires like Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates promise big money to push energy transition. In your blog, The Energy Adventurer, you reveal two fossil fuel heavyweights appear to be shifting a little towards greener power. Please tell us about Mukesh Ambani and the world's largest oil refinery.
Yes, there's two. I think one big trend we've seen is that solar in particular and renewables generally have gone from smaller companies here, upstarts that have made tremendous progress and have driven the price of solar really down like 90-some percent, 95-plus percent, I believe, and made solar and renewable energy really the cheapest form of energy in India, at least while it's being delivered. But a big trend recently is that, you know, not only is the government staking big, ambitious plans to roll out a big uptick in renewable energy over the next, you know, 10, 20 years, but big companies here like Mukesh Ambani's Reliance Corporation, Gautam Adani's is another giant mogul here that's built his fortune on oil and gas. NTPC is the big, largely government-owned power generator, that very, very coal-based. They're all moving quite decisively toward renewable energy. Now, that doesn't mean they're cutting back necessarily on fossil fuels. In fact, at the world's largest refinery that I visited recently, they are making, you know, record margins refining oil and a significant chunk of it, Russian oil. You know, they're not, and Adani is kind of a coal baron in some ways. He's got a giant, very controversial coal mine in Australia, mines in Indonesia. They're bringing in coal as fast as they can bring it in. They're refining oil and gas as fast as they can refine it right now. So they're not giving up on that. And yet they are putting quite massive resources into renewable energy. Right next to the oil refinery that I visited, where they're doing all that, taking in all that oil from everywhere, including Russia, they are also laying the groundwork for a giant solar panel manufacturing facility. And that will be eventually, according to Reliance, followed by a hydrogen electrolyzer plant, a fuel cell plant, and a battery plant, all on a massive scale. Now, those are all still on paper. It will be a long time till those are all rolled out. But all in all, that Reliance's plans there, were they to carry them out to the end, and they're pretty serious about it, I think it really is one of the world's most ambitious integrated renewable energy projects. It's really quite huge and typifies India's approach, which is let's build out renewables as fast as we can in many ways, but at the same time, we're going to need traditional fuels as well, and we'll see how that plays out over time. You know, that's a message that a lot of environmentalists find quite scary, because we really need to be reducing coal, you know, starting yesterday, and oil and gas really probably need to follow, not soon afterwards. But the thinking around that is, I think, shifting in India. But, you know, right now the whole energy system is built on coal and imported oil. So it's going to be continue that way for quite some time to come. But it will be interesting to see how renewables, whether they're solar, wind, hydrogen, hydro, how they begin to push, you know, can they basically be built out faster than demand expands and therefore start pushing coal out of the system? I don't think that's beyond the realm of possibility beginning after 2030. You may see things move faster than people expect and are willing to talk about now. But for now, it's a kind of we need it all approach that works for India and is not entirely in line with global goals to reduce emissions globally.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, veteran Asian correspondent Bill Spindle. David Wallace Wells, in an opinion piece in the New York Times, writes, quote, according to one paper cited in its most recent report, India is 31% poorer thanks to climate change, which has already made global inequality 25% worse. So India has actually become poorer than it might have been if they'd had the same stable climate that the West had when we were industrializing. So the game isn't really very fair.
Yeah, and Indians at all levels will be very quick to point all of this out to you. It is not fair. It's not fair that they're paying a higher price for emissions that they are not responsible for. Looking historically, they've contributed a very small portion of the cumulative greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And even today, on a per capita basis, they're really emitting far, far less than the U.S., Europe, Japan, China, everybody. But it is true that they are paying a higher price. South Asia is one of the most exposed areas to climate change, certainly. I think there was a Standard & Poor's consultancy put out a report not long ago saying that its economy is something like 10 times more vulnerable. So Indians are quite aware of this. And the rest of the world should really be too, because if India's economy continues to pay a massive price, and it will be a massive price over the next couple of decades due to this climate exposure, this will redound to the rest of the world to a considerable extent. As I say, India will be not as good a trade partner as it could be. It will be not nearly as effective a security partner as it could have been otherwise. But also, it's just a kind of loss of potential that will, you know, impact India and the rest of the world if things continue like they are.
Well, I think in the old colonial world, there was the thought that their loss is our gain kind of mentality. But surely COVID, among all other things, shows us that if one part of humanity doesn't reach their potential, we all lose a lot. And I wonder, though, looking at Sri Lanka, is the economy of India stable enough to deal with this even more challenging future coming up?
I think India's economy is a lot more stable than Sri Lanka's, for sure, and a lot stronger and less vulnerable to those sorts of things. But that is a bit of an object lesson about where India and other countries could wind up if the combination of, you know, additional challenges from climate impacts combined with poor management of the challenges. You know, and that's, India has generally done far better than Sri Lanka over the last few years, needless to say. But India's government has always struggled to manage the massive population that they have and the massive diversity and economic challenges that they face. So I think being overwhelmed by the climate impact over time is certainly a danger. But I think, you know, that kind of going back to what you're saying about caring about why to care about India, I think the other thing to realize is that there's a lot of potential for foreign investment to share in all of this. India, you know, has an improving investment environment that's always had some challenges, continue to have some challenges, but they're improving the environment. There are huge opportunities for investment in India's renewable energy sector and green technology sector for foreign companies, some of which are already taking advantage of it, Goldman Sachs, the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, a huge sovereign wealth fund. They're big players in India's energy space. Giant pension funds around the world are starting to pour money in. So there's a lot of opportunity, especially if the ways can be found through some of the multilateral institutions like the IMF, the World Bank, particularly the latter, to de-risk some of these investments. The main problem, I think, is that a giant pension fund is conservative enough that it's worried about risk. If the World Bank and international lenders can find ways to mitigate some of that risk for private investors, then you'll see a lot more money coming in. And that's the real promise of India's renewable sector, I think, is that it is so inexpensive to build solar here. Not that it's easy or without its challenges, but it really is the cheapest form of energy, to the extent that there's really enough for both India to cut its energy costs while putting in renewable energy, and at the same time, foreign investors to get a pretty decent return, particularly if some of the risk is taken out of that equation. So there are these massive opportunities to be taken advantage of. So it's not just avoiding the disastrous potential down the road of these things. It's that there's a lot of potential gain for everybody involved to try to build out India's renewable sector as fast as it can be built out, and hopefully fast enough so that it really exceeds the growth of energy demand, and therefore you can begin to push coal out of the system and get India to a point where it can see huge energy growth, which is what it's going to have because its population is growing, its economy is growing quite rapidly. Its energy use is going to double over the next 20, 30 years. And somehow that has to happen without doubling, tripling its emissions. In fact, it needs to do it by, under its own goal, by reducing its emissions eventually down to net zero by 2070. That's a huge challenge and a different challenge than the developed world really faces. But that's India's challenge, and there are ways that foreign investment could play a huge role in that. And that's really, I think, what the next big climate conference, these COP conferences they have every year that's going to be held this year in Egypt, I think that's really going to be the big issue there, is to what extent and how is the developed world going to contribute and find ways to help India and the developing world in this transition in ways that can very well benefit the investors as well.
Bill Spindle, how long have you been in India on this trip?
This trip, I've been here, I got here in February, started in the northeastern part of the country in February. So I'm about 4 months in, I've got 2 months to go. I was living in India for 4 years prior to 2020. So I'm familiar with it, but I'm learning all sorts of new things as you do when you travel.
Yes, in the East, you talk about it in your Energy Adventure blog. You take us on a tour of some threatened places as you go. Do you want to talk about the Sundarbans? Is that how you pronounce it, Sundarbans?
Yeah, the Sundarbans are a globally unique ecosystem, the largest mangrove tidal estuary in the world. About 40% of it is in India. The other 60% is in Bangladesh. And it is an area that is uniquely vulnerable to climate impacts, partly because it's very low-lying to begin with. Much of it is basically at sea level, barely above sea level. So as sea levels begin to rise, they combine with the other big climate impact they're seeing there, which is more frequent than intense cyclones. And so you get these combinations of higher water levels with huge storm surges from these more intense cyclones and rain from these more intense cyclones. And it really has created big challenges for an area that's really used to things like flooding. And, you know, flooding is part of life there, and they've learned how to deal with it over time. Cyclones are part of life there. They've always had big storms come in occasionally. What's different now is that those storms are happening not once a decade, but well, they've had four in the last basically 2 years, a year and a half, really. And, you know, where they had a cycle before, you'd have a big storm, you'd have a lot of damage, saltwater gets into the rice fields, that makes them basically unfarmable for at least a year or so. As they begin to recover, they need then monsoon rains to begin to lower the salinity level. So over time, they would adjust. And that was a fairly manageable task for a population that's really quite poor. There's about 4 million people there that really generally quite poor. But they could adjust to those sorts of cycles. What's happening now is that they're being battered so hard and so often that adjustment really becomes difficult. It's that being overwhelmed factor on a kind of middle, a kind of small scale here. And they're having a hard time adjusting. So I went to an island called Goramara, which is basically eroding away, as islands have done there in the past over long stretches of time. This island's lost about half its land mass and about more than half its population in the last 5 to 10 years, really, as it's been battered by these storms, including one last year that literally put the whole island under 11 feet of water, wiped out everything. Amazingly, there were no deaths during the storm itself. They were managed to get into their cyclone shelter above the water level, barely, but the whole island went underwater. They lost everything, and really it's, at this point, there's really no salvaging much of the other. Are a couple thousand people still living there. They have no electricity. They're not ever going to get electricity because the government has basically written the island off at this point. The goal at this point is to slowly relocate the population elsewhere. And so that's a kind of situation that the Sundarbans has faced. I spent a lot of time looking at mangrove restoration, which is one of the main reasons that many of the islands down there and the communities are quite vulnerable, is because they've dredged out or one way or another killed off the mangrove swamps the stands of mangroves that provide a lot of protection against those kinds of storms. You know, there you have that combination of sort of human behavior and human interaction with the environment that isn't very well managed, either by the government or the communities themselves, leaving them more vulnerable. And so then climate change comes along with kind of additional challenges, and they're really quite vulnerable to it. That's a pattern you're seeing over and over here. I'm not only here, but everywhere around the world.
That's the thing. I think you've given us a great vision of India, but it's also kind of a portrait of the future in so many places. Bill Spindle has reported from Asia for Newsday, Bloomberg, and the Wall Street Journal. You can keep up with Bill's insights in his blog, The Adventurer, and the address is billspindle.substack.com. I will put links to that and more in my own show blog at ecoshock.org, as always. Bill, thank you for sharing your insight with our listeners.
Thanks, Alex. It's been great to be able to do this. Really enjoyed it.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Climate change is carbon dioxide, right? Except at least 20% of global warming comes from methane. It is a wild west for methane emissions, with hardly any rules or controls out there. This super potent greenhouse gas is increasing every year. Methane more than doubled pre-industrial levels, warming the planet and helping kill millions by increased smog. New science led by Kathleen Marr suggests old ideas about methane can be dangerous. Dr. Kathleen Marr heads a key climate study group at the Institute for Advanced Sustainability Studies. That's in Potsdam, Germany. Kathleen's doctorate in atmospheric chemistry is from the University of California, and she has worked at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. From Potsdam, Kathleen Marr, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
In recent years, shocking heat waves struck many parts of the world, including my home in Western Canada. But now heat wave seems to become extreme heat months in Pakistan and India. Kathleen, is it possible rising methane is contributing to earlier than expected warming?
I have a couple aspects of answering this question. One is it's certainly clear that methane is one important contributor to the warming that we are already experiencing. So the latest IPCC report tells us that we are already at 1.1 degrees Celsius global warming above the pre-industrial average. Methane is certainly a contributor to that, at least to about 20% of the existing warming. I can't tell you from my research how much of the specific heat waves are coming from methane, and I guess I would also push back on the idea that this warming is earlier than expected. I think, you know, also maybe 20 years ago, 10 years ago even, we thought about global warming as a problem of the future, but really global warming is here and different parts of the world are experiencing it with different intensity. But as I mentioned, we're already 1.1 degrees of warming. So I'm not sure that these heat waves are necessarily unexpected.
Well, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change includes methane. In the new paper, you and your co-authors write, quote, the UNFCCC framework neglects the impacts of CH4, which is methane, has on near-term climate. Could you explain that, please?
Methane is a greenhouse gas, and it's covered under the UNFCCC, which is the UN Climate Convention. The latest big agreement was the Paris Agreement, which many of you have heard of. And among the greenhouse gases, CO2 is the most prominent, also the most important. And all the other greenhouse gases, their impact on warming gets compared to the impact of CO2, and specifically looking at how much warming it causes over 100 years. So CO2 is very long-lived in the atmosphere, which is one of the things that makes it very challenging, because when we stop emitting CO2 today, the CO2 we emitted yesterday, like even if we stopped all our CO2 emissions magically, the CO2 we emitted yesterday, a huge portion would still be in the atmosphere 100 years from now. So this is one of the reasons that makes climate change as a problem so intractable. The thing about methane is, in comparison to CO2, if you look at this 100-year warming, they use a metric called global warming potential over 100 years, and methane on a ton-per-ton basis is about 30 times more potent of a warmer than CO2. So as a molecule, methane is a strong absorber. It leads to a lot of warming. But the thing about methane that's different from CO2 is that it gets removed from the atmosphere much more quickly, primarily through chemical processes. But that means its lifetime is on the order of 10 to 12 years. That means it gets removed from the atmosphere much more quickly. So if we look at short time frames, if we only look at consider the warming impact over 20 years, for instance, then methane is about 80 times more powerful of a warmer than CO2. So going back to the UNFCCC with your question, everything under the UNFCCC is kind of uses this GWP 100, this 100-year time frame, as the metric. But that means that methane's impact on near-term warming is overlooked, neglected, underrepresented.
We all want to know, where is the new methane coming from? A scientist like you and Nisbet, who was on our program, he found the largest source of increasing methane are tropical bogs. But citing a 2020 study led by another guest, Rob Jackson, you write, a new study concludes that the recent growth is due in roughly equal parts to emissions from fossil fuel sources and the combined emissions from agricultural and waste sources, end quote. So the methane budget's not settled in science?
That is my perception. So that is not my particular area of expertise. I read a lot of these studies. So methane budget means, like, if you imagine the amount of methane in the atmosphere is like your bank account. The how much money is in your bank account is the balance between how much is going in the case of methane, the emissions, and how much is being taken out. And in the case of methane, that's chemical decomposition primarily. But that's what it means when people are trying to figure out what the methane budget is. It's not so easy to measure slash calculate. There's different methods of doing that, and the different methods come up with some different answers. So I did cite this study by Jackson, which is quite recent, but I think it's not completely resolved as a matter of scientific inquiry where exactly the primary sources of the methane increases are coming from.
One thing the science community does agree on, the worrying rise in methane is not coming from the Arctic. Is that a surprise?
I don't think so. To me, it's not a surprise. So I know there's concern about permafrost melting in the Arctic, for instance, as a source of methane. But when I read the scientific studies in more detail about that, first of all, it's not expected so soon. It would be more relevant on like a 50-year time frame. And the other thing about permafrost is that when it melts, you create methane kind of under the earth, under the permafrost, but a lot of it becomes CO2 by the time it's emitted in the atmosphere, which doesn't mean it's less of a climate problem. It's the permafrost melting will lead to methane, but also CO2 emissions. So for me, it's not a surprise that methane is not coming from the Arctic.
Jackson finds we're heading towards the hottest scenario envisioned by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is 4.3 degrees C of warming by the year 2100. What does your study group expect for methane levels by 2050?
So I have to say here that we are not the ones making these sort of projections. So the study that I recently published on methane, it's really kind of an interdisciplinary synthesis study where we're synthesizing the many different aspects of the natural science together with a view on the governance, so the social and political science of methane. So unfortunately, I'm the wrong expert to ask about that one.
Okay. And your paper finds methane heats the planet in so many ways, four by my count. Kathleen, talk to us about the three continuing impacts as methane breaks down.
Methane, when it ends up in the atmosphere, gets broken down by chemical reactions. So the chain of chemical reactions is usually started by what's known as the hydroxyl radical, OH. And then you get these byproducts, you get these intermediate products as methane is broken down. And one important one is tropospheric ozone. Ozone itself is also a climate warmer. It warms the atmosphere, so you have a warming impact from one of methane's degradation products, and perhaps even more importantly, tropospheric ozone is an air pollutant. So when you breathe it, it irritates your lungs, it causes asthma as well as other health problems associated with COPD, for instance. The end product of methane oxidation is actually CO2. So there's a little bit of a two-for-one there. So when this chemistry, this chain of chemistry is finished, we end up with CO2. We know CO2 is also warming. And another small byproduct of methane oxidation is water in the stratosphere, stratospheric water vapor, that also has a warming impact. Going back to tropospheric ozone, so I mentioned the health effects of tropospheric ozone, but that actually has further effects. Ozone is free radical. Back, I don't know, in the 90s, this was a popular term for things that were harmful, but basically tropospheric ozone is very reactive. So it not only reacts in your lungs, but it damages plants and causes crop losses. So there's estimates of the damages to crops that are due to ozone. And there's a good indication that it reduces the land carbon storage. So you think of forests, for instance, as absorbing carbon. There's a potential for damage by ozone to then reduce, basically harm the plants and reduce their ability to uptake carbon, although that's a very complicated, there's very complicated relationships there, so that piece is associated with more scientific uncertainty.
So these new additional gases from the breakdown and the impacts on the possible buffering ability of plant life, those things aren't really and can't really be included in just talking about a carbon dioxide equivalent, as the UN body tends to do.
Yeah, that's pretty much exactly the point of the article I just wrote. So when we treat methane as simply a CO2 equivalent by a factor of 30, we're missing some pieces. And, of course, the most important thing is that we emit less methane, that we practically stop emitting methane, regardless of why or, you know, how the legal structure is. But, for instance, you know, if you think about carbon markets or carbon pricing schemes, there are a few. Many that exist don't include methane, and the ones that do are also at the price based on its CO2 equivalent. But, you know, for instance, if you wanted to take into account the strong near-term warming impact or any of the other impacts, it's not included in that sort of scheme.
You are an atmospheric chemist, Kathleen Maher. Do we know if climate change itself will create more methane emissions?
We have some ideas, but there's a lot of scientific uncertainty. So basically, it comes down to the question of natural methane sources. So, of course, the anthropogenic sources are under our control, let's say, for instance, fossil fuels, oil and gas. The other important sources are waste management, and also agriculture. But as the Earth gets warmer, what happens to the natural sources? So, for instance, wetlands are the most important natural source of methane right now. And how much methane they emit is determined by many factors, including the soil temperature, water table depth, vegetation cover and composition. These are all things that are affected, will be affected by climate change, but it's very difficult to say exactly how that's going to have an effect on methane emissions. But basically, the scientific understanding right now is that it will lead to more methane emissions under climate change from wetlands, for instance, but it's pretty hard to quantify. Also, this permafrost melting, for instance, I mentioned before, it's possible that will lead to significantly increased methane emissions, but we don't really know when or how much. But on the whole, it doesn't look so good that more climate change means more natural methane emissions. It's probably the case.
I gather methane itself is not a poisonous gas for us, but health concerns do emerge from methane. Could you talk to us about how that works?
Yeah, so from an air pollution perspective, things are usually considered air pollutants if you breathe it in, and then breathing it in has a harmful effect. And so for this reason, methane has never really been categorized as an air pollutant because itself, you just breathe it in and breathe it out. It's inert. But it's a very important precursor or source of tropospheric ozone. So when methane sticks around in the atmosphere for a little while, it begins to react, and then you create ozone. And as mentioned before, ozone is then a serious air pollution and health problem. It damages the lungs. It's associated with asthma, COPD, and other lung diseases. And in fact, you know, there's other precursors to tropospheric ozone, but as air pollution controls improve on the whole globally, methane is becoming a more and more important source of tropospheric ozone. So it's going to become important to address it in an air pollution context as well.
There are some regulatory things going on. First of all, can big companies or countries excuse fossil fuel emissions at home by purchasing an offset credit related to methane as they can for carbon dioxide?
Yes. For instance, if you think internationally, it would be possible for a company to say, okay, it's too expensive for me to reduce my own carbon emissions, so I'm going to invest in and essentially pay for this project in a different country. And let's say this project captures methane from landfills, then yes, that can go on their accounting sheet. It's always a question of who, accounting of carbon is very tricky. It's always a question of who's counting what system it is. But under the UNFCCC, these projects are allowed. As we get to a future very soon where we really shouldn't be emitting, using fossil fuels at all, like this becomes problematic. We just have to stop emitting. But this is possible, yeah.
From Potsdam, Germany, you are listening to scientist Kathleen Marr on the new understanding of methane. Why is it building in the atmosphere? How much is it heating planet Earth? This is Radio EcoShock, blasting around the world from ecoshock.org.
There are annual meetings about the Convention of the Parties to Agreements on Climate Change. We had COP26 in Scotland. Is there an international body charged with regulating and reducing air pollution?
The short answer is no. Well, there's no treaty. So the UNFCCC is a treaty, and then under this treaty, there's all these meetings, and it produced the Paris Agreement, for instance. There's no treaty covering air pollution globally. UN Environment, the UNEP Environment Program, or UNEP, is increasingly doing more on air pollution, and falls under them as a UN agency, at least because it's an environmental issue, but there's increasing attention to air pollution within UNEP, and they have some resolutions about air pollution, but there's no global treaty now.
Do we really know how much methane each country is putting into the atmosphere?
I would say yes, but with what precision and accuracy, it gets a little bit fuzzy. So in terms of emissions, each country is required to submit reports to the UNFCCC about their emissions, including methane emissions. They do that for the most part. There's also, besides self-reporting, there's scientific methodologies to, make independent estimates. People do that. That doesn't mean there aren't uncertainties. And right now, the two biggest uncertainties with kind of political ramifications are, one, particularly in the oil and gas sector, there have been studies that show, basically using infrared cameras to detect methane leaks, and studies that show, okay, the emissions that are being reported are way too low, or that there's way more leaks than that companies are either aware of or reporting. So that's a sort of uncertainty. And as well, from agriculture, the methodologies for estimating emissions are less advanced, let's say. There has been some progress on this front. There's a new initiative under the UN called IMEO, the International Methane Emissions Observatory. So fundamentally, they're going to be compiling data from many sources to calculate methane emissions. But one of the important sources is satellite data, so there has been significant advances in the science on being able to detect methane emissions from satellites. So that information is getting better and better.
In most countries, I could drill into the ground and release lots of methane without breaking any laws, national or international. In fact, most gas fracking operations vent new wells with methane for a couple of weeks before they capture the natural gas. That's why I called it a Wild West situation. This gas, which is so dangerous to both climate and human health, how can it remain free to dump into the air in any amounts?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think part of the answer, at least, is that it's an example of the technology of fracking then outpacing the regulation. And then in the U.S., for instance, depending on who was in the government, also then not very much appetite for regulation. I can say So I worked at the EPA for several years, but that was now 10 years ago, so I'm less up to date than I used to be. But, you know, methane and CO2 are covered under the United States Clean Air Act, but specific regulations, not too many have been passed. So, yeah, that's the situation. And on an international level, it's like at the UNFCCC process, it's about countries reporting their total emissions and then also reducing their total emissions and setting goals, but at the international level.
So while we await international action, there are some voluntary efforts, which you talk about in your paper. They seem like more or less self-regulation by oil and gas companies in one case. Considering the danger, they don't sound like much. Your thoughts?
I guess I have a slightly more positive view. Focusing on the international level, which is also where my research focuses mostly, I mean, we have the Paris Agreement, there's legally binding aspects of it, but fundamentally it's about, there is no international environmental police that's going to enact a punishment if a country doesn't meet their climate targets. So even, let's say, the formal binding agreements, some aspects have a voluntary character as well. For instance, so one initiative at COP26, the Global Methane Pledge, was launched. This pledge is to, now let me look at the numbers, I think it's to reduce global methane emissions by 30% by 2030. And I think it helps to have political attention, momentum. Of course, getting then implementation on the ground is always the tricky part. So, yeah, I guess I wouldn't be too... I have some hope that, let's say, the voluntary partnerships and voluntary initiatives really can achieve something. In the case of oil and gas, you mentioned, you know, voluntary efforts on their part. One source of optimism, at least for some, is that, you know, the oil and gas companies do actually should have a self-incentive to capture their methane because it's their product. So if they leak less, they can sell more and make more money. So on the one hand, it should be a no-brainer, and this should be something that's a solution that's easy to implement because they are on board. So that's where I'm coming from on that end.
So here we are, somewhat still in the dark about one of the biggest threats growing in the atmosphere in methane, and time is short. Is it too late for emergency action to slash methane emissions by humans?
I think when in these conversations about climate, questions about is it too late, they almost become philosophical questions. So, no, the answer is, you know, if we want to meet the Paris goal of staying within 1.5 degrees of warming, a lot has to happen very soon, and it's technically possible. Whether it's politically possible is more doubtful, but it's not that, you know, the laws of physics are preventing us, or also that, you know, we're lacking the technologies to do this. But of course, keeping global warming between under 1.5 degrees is looking less and less likely. I also come from the perspective that it's actually never too late. So we have these Paris goals. We want to keep global warming well below 2 degrees and ideally below 1.5 degrees. But, you know, if we reach 2.1 degrees of warming, it doesn't mean we should give up, because 2.1 degrees of warming is way better than 2.5 degrees, and it's definitely way better than 4 degrees of warming. So basically, the less warming we have, the better. So late action is better than no action. But yeah, to reach our Paris goals, we need a lot of action now, and certainly more than we've seen to date.
What are you working on next?
Yeah, that's a good question. In the very near future, I'm traveling to Bonn for what's called the Intersessionals. It's the preparatory meeting for the big UN climate conference, which will be in Egypt at the end of the year. I have an interest in kind of the meta level of what you might call science policy interface. So how can scientists and policymakers best interact? What's fruitful there? And really thinking about information exchange. That it's not about one-way knowledge transfer from science to policy. It's much more complex than that. So that's one of the things I'm working on, and also thinking about on a practical level, assessing needs of the science policy interface on methane, with the idea to maybe launch some sort of science policy platform. But these are ideas rather than concrete plans at the moment. Other than that, my group at the ISS, Institute for Advanced Sustainability Studies in Germany, we have kind of a dual focus. One is really engaging in political processes, including the UNFCCC, but also the Climate and Clean Air Coalition, which is also a coalition that's, among other things, trying to advance and accelerate action on methane, and combining with that with our interdisciplinary research, combining physical sciences, but also then social and political science.
We really need that combination of social and political science with raw science, because that's what it's going to take. We have been speaking with Dr. Kathleen Marr. She leads the new paper, Beyond CO2 Equivalents, the Impacts of Methane on Climate, Ecosystems, and Health. That is open access. It's free for you to read, listeners. And you can find links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Kathleen, thank you for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
There must have been people living in the 1400s who realized the whole story of devils and angels was a hoax, along with the kings supposedly appointed by God. The few woke up in the morning and knew their civilization was insane. Parts of humanity have always been mad, I guess, including the Greeks and the Romans with their wars, slaves, and superstition. You and I are in a position now that is not new. We hope, we try, even if the wave of awakening seldom comes in time. I'm Alex. Thank you for continuing with Radio EcoShock in your ears. Thank you for caring about this wondrous world.
Dan Berggren, Power from Above.
Sinners, are you ready for a little redemption, to receive forgiveness for what we've done? The time has come to break bad habits. It's time to turn to the wind and sun. Just a little more power from above. Just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. There's a better way than barrels of oil. There's a better way than lumps of coal. There's a better way to work together. Renewable power, that's our goal.
That's our goal.
Just a little more power from above. Just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. What will we do for a better world? Get on your knees to hope and pray. Well, that's not enough unless we change. The judgment day is every day. Wars have been fought over who owns what. Lives have been lost and fortunes won. But you and I will someday win. Cause no one owns,
no one owns
the wind or sun. Just a little more power from above. Just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. Just a little more power.
From Alex Smith, no less. Oh, well, I just happened to have caught this morning's latest Democracy Now! Top headlines. So I'm going to play that, and then we'll go right into TUC Radio.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Voters on Tuesday went to the polls for primaries in seven states, California, Iowa, Montana, New Mexico, South Dakota, New Jersey, and Mississippi. In one of the closely watched races, voters in San Francisco recalled Chesa Boudin as district attorney of San Francisco. Boudin is a progressive prosecutor who aimed to reform the criminal justice system, but he faced mounting attacks by the real estate industry, Republicans, and some Democrats. In Los Angeles, mayoral race, billionaire real estate developer Rick Caruso and former Congressmember Karen Bass are headed to a runoff in November after placing first and second in Tuesday's primary. Caruso is a Republican-turned-Democrat who sits on the board of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library. Caruso spent at least $39 million of his own fortune on the race. Bass is attempting to become the first female mayor of Los Angeles and the city's second black mayor. Meanwhile, in Montana, Donald Trump's former Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke, is in a close race in a Republican primary to win back his old House seat. We'll have more on the primaries after headlines. Bipartisan negotiations on new federal gun laws are continuing in the Senate, but several key proposals are already off the table, including a new federal ban on assault weapons, new background checks, and new restrictions on high-capacity ammunition magazines. Instead, lawmakers are focusing on school safety and mental illness. On Tuesday, Congress heard testimony from the son of 86-year-old Ruth Whitfield, who was gunned down by a white supremacist last month at a Buffalo grocery store with nine other black shoppers. Garnell Whitfield urged Congress to act.
And ask yourself, is there nothing that we can do? Is there nothing that you personally are willing to do to stop the cancer of white supremacy and the domestic terrorism it inspires? Because if there is nothing, then, respectfully, senators, you should yield your positions of authority and influence to others that are willing to lead on this issue. My mother's life mattered. My mother's life mattered. And your actions here today will tell us how much it matters to you.
Meanwhile, the Oscar-winning actor Matthew McConaughey spoke at the White House press briefing on Tuesday for more than 22 minutes. McConaughey is a gun owner from Uvalde, Texas, the site of last month's school massacre where 19 students and two teachers were shot dead.
We need background checks. We need to raise the minimum age to purchase an AR-15 rifle to 21. We need a waiting period for those rifles. We need red flag laws and consequences for those who abuse them. These are reasonable, practical, tactical regulations to our nation, states, communities, schools, and homes. Responsible gun owners are fed up with the Second Amendment being abused and hijacked by some deranged individuals.
Matthew McConaughey and his wife spent a week in his hometown of Uvalde after the massacre, meeting with the loved ones of the massacre victims. On Tuesday, former Congressmember Gabby Giffords, who was shot in an assassination attempt in 2011 in a Tucson shopping market, spoke at the opening of a temporary memorial for victims of gun violence at the National Mall in Washington, D.C.
Stopping gun violence takes courage. The courage to do what's right. The courage to new ideas. I've seen great courage when my life was on the line. Now is the time to come together. Be responsible. Democrats, Republicans, everyone. We must never stop fighting. Fight, fight, fight. Be bold. Be courageous. The nation's counting on you. Thank you very much.
Gabby Giffords turns 52 years old today. Last night, she was in New York for the premiere of the new documentary, Gabby Giffords Won't Back Down, directed by Betsy West and Julie Cohen. Their previous film, My Name is Polly Murray, won a Peabody Award on Tuesday. You can see our coverage of that film at democracynow.org. In Tempe, Arizona, three police officers have been placed on leave after they ignored an unhoused man's pleas to help him from drowning in a lake. The incident began when police responded to a reported disturbance involving 34-year-old Sean Bickings and a companion near Tempe Town Lake last month. After the police arrived, Bickings climbed a metal fence to reach the water. He soon began struggling in the water. According to a police transcript, Bickings said, quote, "I'm drowning." An officer responded saying, quote, "I'm not jumping in after you." Bickings responded by saying, quote, "Oh God, please help me," unquote. Tempe's city manager and police chief have called his drowning a tragedy. Meanwhile, in North Carolina, a county has agreed to pay a $3 million settlement to the family of Andrew Brown Jr., a black father who was fatally shot by police last year. Three sheriff's deputies opened fire on him in his driveway while serving an arrest warrant. An autopsy confirmed Brown died of a gunshot wound to the back of his head. Andrew Brown Jr. was a father of seven children. Italy's foreign minister is warning millions of people could die of hunger if Ukraine's ports are not reopened. Italy's hosting a meeting of Mediterranean nations to discuss the global food crisis. This comes as the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, is in Turkey for talks. Lavrov said the ports can't be reopened until Ukraine removes mines it placed off its coast. Both Ukraine and Russia have been accused of placing mines in the Black Sea. Turkey has offered to provide naval escorts to ships carrying grain from Ukrainian ports. Meanwhile, the United States has accused Russia of trying to sell grain stolen from Ukraine to drought-stricken nations in Africa. In other developments, Russian media is reporting more than 1,000 Ukrainian fighters who surrendered in Mariupol have now been transferred to Russia. More leaders of Latin American countries have announced they will not attend the Summit of the Americas taking place in Los Angeles. The summit's been mired in controversy after the Biden administration refused to invite Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. On Monday, Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, announced he would boycott the talks over Biden's decision. The presidents of Bolivia, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador have also said they will not attend the summit. We'll have more on this story later in the program. An internal U.S. government report has found the State Department and Pentagon have failed to assess how many civilians are being killed with U.S.-made weapons in the U.S.-backed Saudi-led war in Yemen. The report was written by the Government Accountability Office but remains classified. The Saudi-led air campaign has killed nearly 15,000 people in Yemen, striking homes, hospitals, and other civilian targets. This comes as President Biden's facing mounting questions over his plans to travel to Saudi Arabia next month to meet with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. On Tuesday, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre defended Biden's planned trip.
So Saudi Arabia has been a strategic partner of the United States for eight decades. Every president since FDR has met with Saudi leaders. As I've said, the president will meet with any leader if it serves the interests of the American people. That's what he puts first. He believes engagement with Saudi leaders clearly meets that test, as has every president before him.
In other news from the region, the FBI seized the electronic data of retired Marine four-star General John Allen as part of a probe into whether Allen lied about his role in secretly lobbying for the government of Qatar. Allen retired from the Marines in 2013 and became the president of the Brookings Institute in 2017. The Lebanese military says it's arrested 64 people Tuesday as they attempted to sail from northern Lebanon to Europe to seek refuge. The group was made up of people from Lebanon, Syria, and Palestine. They were taken into custody before their boat could set sail from a port near the Lebanese city of Tripoli. This comes just weeks after a boat carrying more than 60 capsized off the coast of Tripoli, killing at least seven and leaving many others missing. Many have fled Lebanon since the country's economic collapse began in 2019, leading to severe shortages in fuel, medicine, and food. A federal judge has ordered Louisiana's new congressional map be redrawn. The judge accused Republicans of racial gerrymandering by packing black voters into a single district in a move that would likely lead to the state having just one black member of Congress. Louisiana has become the 18th state to enact a trans athlete ban. The measure to bar trans girls and women from competing on school sports teams became law after the state's Democratic governor, John Bel Edwards, chose not to veto the legislation. The bill, called the, quote, Fairness in Women's Sports Act, says schools must designate teams based on, quote, biological sex, defined as the sex listed on a person's birth certificate at the time of their birth. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen testified before the Senate Finance Committee Tuesday and warned inflation will remain high.
We currently face macroeconomic challenges, including unacceptable levels of inflation, as well as the headwinds associated with the disruptions caused by the pandemic's effect on supply chains and the effects of supply-side disturbances to oil and food markets resulting from Russia's war in Ukraine.
Yellen's comment comes as the World Bank has warned stagflation in the global economy could have potentially destabilizing consequences in some countries, including the rising risk of malnutrition and even famine. Meanwhile, U.S. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell has faced some criticism after recently saying one of his goals in combating inflation was to, quote, get wages down. And workers at a Starbucks in Memphis, Tennessee, have voted to unionize after the Workers United Union won an election to represent the store's baristas on Tuesday. This is the same store that fired seven union activists known as the Memphis Seven, who were trying to organize back in February. The store is now one of the approximately 115 Starbucks locations that have voted to unionize in recent months. This is Nikki Taylor of the Memphis Seven.
We just won. After a fight that almost took, I know, me out, I want to say thank you to our supporters across the nation that have held us down, all our supporters here in the city of Memphis. Memphis is a union town, and Poplar Highland is unionized, baby.
To see our interview with another member of the Memphis Seven, you can go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
You can catch Democracy Now!, of course, at their website, democracynow.org. But here in Northeast Kansas, you can catch it at 7 a.m. on 19.2, the PBS affiliate out of Kansas City. That's 19.2 over the air for free. And at 8 a.m. at KKFI FM radio, 90.1. Coming up now is the latest of TUC Radio by Mariah Gillard, who, by the way, broadcasts off the grid from her studio home in Northern California.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Hazel Henderson and Edward Goldsmith, visionaries of a new economy in opposition to the global trade agreements. On May 7, 2022, I heard Hazel Henderson in a spirited interview on the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. She was introduced as personal friend and advocate for an economy based on cooperation and sharing. Someone once said, "It's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism." Well, the visionary Hazel Henderson had a remarkable imagination for a green economy of the solar age, and I hope you'll look her up on the Nader Radio Hour archive. So sadly, she died, age 89, only 2 weeks after the interview. And here's my tribute to her. I met Hazel Henderson in 1993 and recorded her whenever she visited San Francisco. Here's her still totally timely critique of economics.
Hazel Henderson was one of the keynote speakers at the International Healthy Cities Conference in San Francisco, California, in December of 1993. She is an economist and author. Her books, Creating Alternative Futures, The Politics of the Solar Age, and Paradigms in Progress, have been translated in many languages, including Dutch and Chinese. Hazel Henderson is one of the directors of the World Watch Institute and founded the Center for Sustainable Development in St. Augustine, Florida, where she lives. She does her errands by bicycle and boycotts shopping malls and large department stores. Hazel Henderson.
We need to see the world anew. We need to reframe all those debates we see on TV and in the newspaper headlines that lead us to believe that free markets have triumphed, free trade is always good for everyone, global competitiveness is the new goal everywhere, economic efficiency is the top priority, citizens are now customers, democracy is equated with markets, budgets must be balanced, deficits are out of control, so cuts in jobs must be inevitable, and the GNP must continue to grow. So how do we sort through all of these inappropriate half-truths? Well, the first thing is to remember economics is not and never was a science. Economics, as we all know now, is simply a 300-year-old grab bag of unverifiable, unrefutable assumptions. And these assumptions are parading as laws. It's extraordinary to me the way economists talk about this law and that law, Say's law and Pareto's laws and all of this, as if they were equivalent to Newton's laws of motion. I mean, you can get to the moon with Newton's laws of motion. You can't get anywhere with these economic assumptions. So let's all remember again that economics is simply a profession, like law. And if you think of it, a cost-benefit analysis is not very much different from a brief that a lawyer prepares for a client to put the best possible spin on what the client wants to do, what the project is. Now, the problem is, though, that lawyers are accountable, just like doctors are. But economists are not accountable. And it's an extraordinary thing to realize that today economists are going around the world prescribing not for individuals, but for whole societies, and creating the most terrible mayhem and human suffering in their wake. Right now, we have a lot of our old economic textbooks are being peddled around in Eastern European countries, and they're trying to recreate 19th century capitalism. What we need, of course, is a 21st century form of sustainable development. So if we're going to move toward a healthy, sustainable society, we have to, first of all, correct the economists' obsolete recipes. And of course, the most important one, as I'm sure a lot of you have been talking about, we've got to change the GNP growth formula and correct it. Because this formula for progress, as you know, was adapted in World War II by Britain and the United States in order to increase the war effort. And the whole idea was to maximize war production at the expense of the civilian economy. And so bombs and bullets and tanks are valued very highly in GNP and GDP. Children count for zero. The environment counts for zero. And even infrastructure counts for zero. So you can imagine with that kind of formula that nobody's looked at since 1945, we are backing into the future looking through the rearview mirror. Trying to guide a complex society using GNP and GDP as your compass is a little like trying to fly a Boeing 747 with nothing on the instrument panel except an oil pressure gauge. So here we are, and we're still on the old GDP growth formula. And in my state and in many of the cities I travel to around the world, you have to call it the plantation model. This is how it goes. The Economic Development Commission in the city or the state goes around the world trying to find some big multinational company to lure in to create jobs. And they say, come on down to Florida. We have cheap land, cheap labor, low taxes, few labor unions, and few environmental regulations. And guess what? We'll also give you a tax holiday. Now, of course, this is simply a recipe for disaster, because what happens is the company comes in, uses all of those concessions, and increases the environmental and social costs to taxpayers and to everybody else. And then when they realize that taxes have to go up to clean up the mess, and we have to have more and more public programs to deal with the victims and the drugs and the crime, then the economists tell the politicians, what you need is more economic growth, and you're back around the treadmill again. What we now have to deal with is this model still operating on a global level. And what we have today is this whole thing about global competitiveness is simply ending up at the end of the line with the new phenomenon called the era of jobless economic growth. And all over the world, the G7 countries, when they met in Tokyo in July, began to talk about jobless economic growth. And of course, it was the whole thrust of the Industrial Revolution, was to do more and more and more with fewer and fewer people. So here we are. The idea was first they automated the agricultural sector and everybody moved into factories. Then they automated the factories and we were told everybody would be finding their jobs in the services sector. And now all that's happened is we're automating the services sectors worldwide. And we have to challenge governments, because what governments did to patch over this gap, this automation gap for the last 20 years was basically warfare, workfare, and welfare. And now we can't do that anymore because the old Keynesian stimulation won't work because it's colliding with these ever-rising deficits. So here is our opportunity to get back into the discussion and talk about the reality of the new global game. And what's happened now is as all of the niches in these old marketplaces are filled up and the economy goes global, we have to recognize that it too is a global commons. And when a market shifts to a commons, the competitive rules of win-lose don't work anymore. The shift has to be to win-win. And it has to be not leveling that global playing field downward the way the economists would do it, which just means leveling rainforests and trying to homogenize all the cultures in the world. It means raising an ethical floor under the global playing field, where the girder work of national agreements and treaties around ozone, around worker safety, around human rights, all can lift this global floor so that eventually the best companies and the most ethical countries can win rather than losing the way they do today. And so today we have these two failing institutions, national governments and global corporations. And instead, what we see happening in the world is a third sector is emerging, the global civic culture. That's us. and we are communicating with each other. And what we are finding is that not only are we beginning to build this third force where most social innovation comes from, because social innovation never comes from the center, always from the margins. We can all learn from each other. And I think that we all know that we can build a win-win world, and that in this new global context, all our self-interests are identical. The golden rule was right. It was simply a good statement of systems theory. And Earth ethics now has simply become pragmatic. Thank you.
That was my archival program with Hazel Henderson, recorded in San Francisco in December 1993. She was an important critic of industrial age economics, and campaigned, along with notables such as ecologist Edward Goldsmith and Ralph Nader, against the emerging trade agreements such as NAFTA and GATT that later became the WTO. Here's my recording of Edward Goldsmith. This is how I introduced him in 1994.
Edward Goldsmith, philosopher and activist from England, is considered one of the best informed and radical thinkers of the environmental movement. The Green Party used his book, The Blueprint for Survival, to formulate the founding document. Edward Goldsmith spoke at a briefing on the impact of the so-called free trade agreements like the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. Edward Goldsmith.
We all think that trade is necessary. We think it's normal. In fact, gross national product, in terms of which we gauge the wealth of a nation, is really a summation of all the transactions. It's entirely based on trade. No trade, internal or external, and there's no GNP. And we're supposed to be very, very poor. I think it's in our character as humans to see the things we've been brought up with as normal. Our political scientists look at today's political system and they assume this is a normal political system. The fact that it doesn't work, the fact that you can't point to any government in the world that is actually doing its job and they're helping solve any problem, doesn't seem to affect them, doesn't seem to lead them to question this. Karl Polanyi, that very well-known, very remarkable economic historian who wrote in the 30s and 40s, pointed out to the dismay of the world of economists that the principles of economics which they had formulated and which they assumed to have universal applicability applied only to industrial man, and that it applied in no way to tribal or traditional man. He could look around in tribal society, in archaic societies of old, and he would see no sign of homo economicus. And things are not produced or sold to maximize the return on any factor of production, i.e. to satisfy any real economic goal. Goods was made and distributed simply to satisfy kinship obligations and to achieve social prestige. In the case of people like the big men in Melanesia who give big feasts and acquire prestige in this manner, without accumulating any capital goods of any kind. Often they're the poorest looking people in the area. He referred to the ways goods were distributed in traditional societies as reciprocity and redistribution. You give things away, you get them back, you redistribute goods among your community as a means of obtaining social prestige in general. Of course, if you interfere with this process, you get chaos. You get to our type of society. The typical example of reciprocity and redistribution, which you find in some of the Pacific Islands near New Zealand, and some of the Pacific Islands where people live largely off fish, on the atolls, if somebody catches a fish, he gives a feast. And, of course, when somebody else catches a fish, they'll also give a feast, and he'll be invited to that feast. So in a sense, he's getting something back. He's using his friends as deep freezes. And, in fact, that's very much the choice we have today. Do we want friends or deep freezes? Because you can't have both, because when the New Zealand government suddenly handed out refrigerators and deep freezes to people, They stopped giving feasts. You didn't need them anymore. So now you don't have feasts anymore. You eat frozen fish instead of good fresh fish. Your social bonds are destroyed because it was these feasts that maintained social bonds. Society is collapsing as a result, with all the obvious consequences. This whole principle, to me, is critical. The goods and the economic activities in general, including trading activities in a traditional society, were not designed to achieve economic goals, but designed to achieve social ends. I quote in my book, this man called Huber, describes the economic system of a tribe in New Guinea called the Angor. And he points out the object of their agricultural activities is not to produce food, but to produce social organization. Of course, this whole principle is very much part of the philosophy of Mahatma Gandhi. In fact, it's Sundarlal Bahugana, whom we all know, regarded it as the most basic principle of Gandhi's philosophy, that you had to buy within your village. He himself was a great Chipko activist. I don't know if you know about the Chipko movement, you know, people who stream out of their villages, mainly women, to embrace the trees when the government loggers appear, cut the forest down. They know that once the trees go, the soil goes away, the water table sinks, and they no longer have any food to eat or water to drink. Sundarlal Bahugana is one of the leaders of this movement, for he only wears clothes that come from his village. He will never accept any clothes of any kind, give him any gift, but if it doesn't come from his village, he won't wear it. You know, when he's there, he only eats things from his village. He's very, very difficult to feed, actually. One doesn't know how he survives. In the Indian village of old, where the farmer produced food, which he gave to the potter, the blacksmith, the barber, in exchange for their services, he would, by the way, not at a price determined by the market, but at a price established by tradition. Well, he would buy his pots in his village. He'd have his hair cut by the barber. Regardless of how used to say, well, if there was a completely drunken barber who would sort of chop his ears off every time he had his hair cut, he'd still go to him. And if the potter was also half drunk and made very small pots, so what? Even if you could buy bigger pots elsewhere, this is not important. Importance is not the size of the pots or the ability of the hairdresser. What is important is to maintain these social bonds, see, which assure the cohesiveness of their community, which provided people with their main wealth. It's a form of wealth whose very existence we ignore. We don't realize that if you take a man from his traditional village, where he lives in his family, an extended family, and in his community, and all the various associations of which he's part, and you dump him in some distant town, you are depriving him of a form of wealth which it is almost impossible to compensate for. This wealth we ignore. We only realize it when we see the consequences of destroying our own societies. When you see this massive epidemic of delinquency, drug addiction, crime, which can only be interpreted as the symptoms of social and cultural deprivation, the results of destroying your community in the interests of maximizing economic development. Now, it's interesting to see what happens when you start trading. In New Zealand, when they started developing and setting things on the market, they cashed in all their whales. The first people to go there were whalers, the first white people. So they cashed in the whole whale, all the whales. When there were no whales, they cashed in all the seals. When there were no seals, they found there was a wonderful tree called the kauri tree. There are 3 million acres of these trees. They're wonderful, like your redwood. They cashed that lot in. When they cashed all that in, they looked around. They found there were some wonderful scallop beds in the Marlborough Sounds between the two islands. They cashed that in. Then they found there was some fantastic, fantastic resource of crayfish, Chatham Islands. They cashed that in a few years. They burned all their trees down and put down 70 million sheep, and that wiped out the soil, so they cashed in the soil as well. Now, this process could only go on if it goes on until there's nothing left of the island, until the whole place is just a desert with a whole lot of starving people. This is not taken into account by the people who advocate the endless expansion of the market. In fact, it's quite evident that if you want to preserve things, you've got to keep them out of the market system. In New Zealand, you have national parks. What's the object of a national park? It's to keep things out of the market system. In Tanzania, the market is broken down. Why? Because there's no money to repair the roads, so they can't export their food anymore. This is a guy, everybody would say, the poor people, they must be very poor. They've got no more money because they can't export their food. But if you can't export your food, something wonderful happens. You can eat your food instead, which they haven't done for 30 years. So now for the first time for 30 years, they're eating their food. They're growing fat in Tanzania. Well, I think I'm finishing off now. All I'm going to say here is that we need to reverse this process. Free trade doesn't really exist in any case, because we know that the market for any single commodity is controlled by a very limited number of corporations. And when we decree that trade is going to be free, we are actually allowing the corporations that control the market in the various commodities to do what the hell they like. We are actually transforming the world into a free trade zone of the type that exists around the airports in many third world countries. Areas, I don't know if you've seen them, where they solicit, they beg, they ask industrialists to settle down, to make things there, to put up their factories, and they offer them the cheapest possible labor legislation, no pollution legislation, nothing at all, tax holidays. They can do what the hell they like. All social, ecological, human, moral considerations are mercilessly and systematically subordinated to the short-term interests of the corporations involved. Now, we are transforming today with the GATT and other free trade arrangements, we are transforming the world into a free trade zone of this type. And if we're going to survive on this planet for more than a few decades, by no means certain of climate change, etc., we've got to do exactly the opposite. We've got to subordinate equally ruthlessly and equally systematically short-term economic interests to social, ecological, and climatic considerations. To do this means reverting to the small market. It means reverting to a society based on the community in which our economic activities are conducted on a very much smaller scale, catering for local markets, very much as people once did before. I don't think we have any alternative for this. We cannot go back to the past, but we must certainly seek our inspiration from the past, because of 95% of our tendency of this planet, people live just this way, and that must be the only way to live. Thank you.
Edward Goldsmith, recorded at a briefing on the impact of GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. In January of 1994, he returned to San Francisco, and I talked to him about the recent conclusion of the Uruguay round of GATT. Since the talk you just heard was given, the binding final document of GATT was produced. After the signing ceremony in Morocco in April 1994, the over 100 members to the GATT are now facing the country-by-country ratification process. I asked Edward Goldsmith to comment on the promises the GATT is making.
The justification for the GATT is that it will increase world trade, and that by increasing world trade, we'll increase economic growth, and that in this way we will be able to fight poverty and fight unemployment. This is a myth. It's more than a myth. It's a lie. It's a gigantic lie, a huge deceit. Now, it's perfectly simple. Since 1950, world trade has increased 11 times. I repeat, 11 times. What has that done for poverty, for jobs? Poverty has increased massively throughout the third world and in countries like America and in Europe too. Unemployment has never been higher. Gross national product during that period has increased 5 times. 500%. Now, if GATT increases gross national product by an extra percent every year, or increases world trade, you know, by a few percent, what are they going to do for us? What's the point of increasing world trade by 10% when you multiplied it by 1,100%? It's done no more than increase poverty and unemployment. It's a complete myth based on that. The GATT is above all, as it's been described, a charter of rights for the multinational corporations. They control the bulk of world trade already. 300 or 400 transnational corporations control about 60 or 70% of world trade. And by removing all the barriers, all the constraints on their operations, all the barriers to their expansion, they're going to be able to control maybe 80 or 90% of world trade. That's all. We're handing the world on a platter to the multinational corporations. With the GATT, we're going to turn the world into one vast free trade zone in which everything goes, in which there are no labor controls, in which there's no pollution control, in which there'll be tax holidays, in which corporations can do what they like.
You can see it already. Now, you wouldn't believe it. The Department of Trade and Industry in England has produced a beautiful, shiny brochure called Invest in Britain. It's addressed to foreign industrialists. It says, invest in Britain, we have the cheapest labor in Europe. Imagine boasting about the fact that the English people are the poorest in Europe. Number two, they say, invest in Britain because we'll guarantee that there will be no new laws, no new environmental or social laws which will increase the cost of your industrial enterprises. Invest in Britain because you don't have to have unionized labor. You can deploy any labor you like. In other words, we are telling foreign industrialists to invest in Britain because Britain has already been transformed into a free trade zone, just like those zones around the airports in third world countries, where industrialists can do what the hell they like. We're reversing all the efforts by people who've tried to control corporations, who've tried to establish norms and guidelines, and we've tried to have social laws to protect workers, environmental laws to protect the environment. All that is being reversed in one fell swoop. The corporations have gone too far. They could probably get away with controlling 50 or 60% of world trade. They're not going to get away with trying to control 80 or 90% of it. They're just not going to get away. There's going to be civil wars everywhere. You're already seeing the civil war in Mexico. You've already seen the election in Canada, where the Conservative Party, which completely controlled the company, has been virtually wiped out because they have been associated more than anything else with the NAFTA. And all the unemployment, present unemployment and misery in Canada is blamed on NAFTA. Yeah, I think you're going to have revolutions and civil wars just about everywhere in the world because that is going to cause such unbelievable misery that people are going to react.
You heard Edward, a.k.a. Teddy Goldsmith, and before him, Hazel Henderson, and their 1993-94 critique of the rules of global trade under GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, that later became the WTO, the infamous World Trade Organization. This rebroadcast from the TUC Radio Archives is in honor of the legacy of Hazel Henderson, who died on May 22nd of this year, and in honor of Edward Goldsmith, who died in August 2009. Their work continues with us. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelaudin. Thank you for listening.